Good evening, everyone. My name is Stephen Wolfolk. I'm the Director of Programming at the Kansas City Public Library. But tonight, it's a real honor to have the opportunity to host Megan Phelps Roper for a discussion of her new book, Unfollow, a memoir of loving and leaving the Westboro Baptist Church. I hope you'll check it out. The book is beautifully written and the story is beautifully told. It's a story of faith. It's a story of personal growth. It's a story of courage. But most importantly, I think, to me anyway, it's a testament to the value of being willing to engage with the people with whom we disagree most. Too often these days, our default setting is hate. The people with whom we disagree, they aren't just wrong, they're deplorable. They're irredeemable. And it's even easier for us to hate someone when we see them as being hateful, whether that person is the President of the United States or a member of the congregation at a small church in Topeka, Kansas. But it wasn't the people who met hate with hate who convinced Megan to question her commitment to Westboro Baptist Church. It was the people who wanted to understand her and her beliefs. It was the people who wanted her to understand them. It was the people who met hate with kindness, the people who were willing to engage, the people who believed in redemption, the people who believed that the best way to convince someone that their ideas are wrong is to offer them a better idea. Megan is joined tonight by Eric McHenry. Eric teaches English at Washburn University. He's the author of 2 books of poetry and has been a critic of the New York Times Book Review since 2001. He served from 2015 to 2017 as the Poet Laureate of Kansas, and Megan says that he is one of her mentors in the writing world. So please welcome to the Kansas City Public Library, Eric McHenry and Megan Phelps Roper.
Thanks, it's an honor to be here. The first words ever directed at me by the Westboro Baptist Church came in a fax sent to the Topeka Capital Journal. I was a lowly staff writer at the paper, just a year or two out of college, but to the author of the facts, I was a vampire journalist, a literary thug, an amoral attack dog, and a slug glommed onto the bottom rung of the ladder of human depravity. Reading it left me with 2 distinct impressions. These people are weird. And these people are really interesting writers. I don't remember the first words that I ever spoke to my dear friend Megan Phelps Roper, and that's probably for the best, because I probably shouted them from a car. But I'm confident that no one hearing them would have predicted that I would one day publicly utter the phrase, "my dear friend Megan Phelps Roper." And yet here we are. It's been one of my life's great privileges to get to know Megan and her story. Over the past several years, she has undergone change on a scale that most of us will never know. Radical reshapings of her faith and worldview, and of the world's view of her. Estrangement from her family, exile from her home, reunion with fellow exiles, marriage to a man whose first words to her were even more offensive than mine, and parenthood to a baby so adorable she makes the Gerber baby look like Wilfred Brimley. I have many interesting friends, but only one whose life will soon be the subject of a motion picture produced by Reese Witherspoon. Yet I'm not sure that Megan herself has changed all that much. I think that she has always been kind, intelligent, brave, open-minded, fair-minded, and given to self-scrutiny, and that those qualities were eventually going to require change in her life. I do think that knowing Megan has changed me. I hope, at any rate, that it has made me slower to judge, less dismissive of those with whom I disagree, more cognizant of the fact that everyone is on an intellectual, moral, and spiritual journey. None of us have arrived. Reading Megan's memoir was a revelation to me. I wasn't shocked to discover that she was a gifted writer. I knew that she was smart and serious about language, and again, that she had come from a family of really interesting writers. But I was stunned by the stories themselves, and by my reaction to them. Reading Megan's rich, riveting accounts of life in the Westboro Baptist fold made me realize how reductive my ideas about them had always been. I was blindsided by the sadness that I felt, not only for Megan and her sister Grace as they made their agonized decision to leave, but for the earnest, caring, complicated, and profoundly misguided parents and relatives who were losing them. To be blunt, I wouldn't have thought myself capable of being moved to tears by a description of the Reverend Fred Phelps on his deathbed, but there you have it. Thinking about Westboro Baptist Church now, I find that I can't summon the anger and contempt that I used to feel. To put it in nerdy English professor terms, when I see a hateful sign holder, I decide to let hateful modify sign, not holder. I try to look upon every member of the church as a future former member of the church and as a future friend of mine. It was a relief and a privilege, Megan has said, to let go of the harsh judgments that instinctively ran through my mind about nearly every person I saw. At a time of dangerous polarization and mistrust in our country, Megan's life is a shining reminder of the power of lowering your voice and listening. It will be a pleasure to listen to Megan Phelps Roper. Megan Phelps Roper is your name. It's Phelps, your mother's last name, and Roper, your father's last name, with a hyphen in between them, which back in the 80s when they got married, the 70s, the 80s, was, you know, kind of a progressive thing to be doing. Certainly, probably an improbably progressive thing for a woman who covered her head when attending church services to be doing. And you had a complicated explanation for that in the book. Can you tell me a little bit about the choice to maintain Phelps in the name in a marriage, in an institution that is patriarchal in many respects?
Yeah, so my mother, when I was a kid, she said that that name, the Phelps name, especially in this part of the country, means something. And at the time, I thought that she meant the protesting. But of course, you know, as I got older, I realized it was a dumb assumption. I know I understood the our protesting to be, that was what we were known for. But my mother explained, you know, long before the protesting, my family was known for the civil rights work that my grandfather and then he required his children to go to law school and their spouses to go to law school to support him in that work. You know, he got, you know, awards from civil rights groups like the NAACP for that work. He was the go-to, you know, for these difficult cases that lawyers, black or white, wouldn't take in those days. So that was the decision to give us, for us to have that legacy as part of our name.
Interesting. Was there ever, not everyone in the family made that choice to keep the Phelps name. Was there ever pushback or resistance? Or this is a community in which everyone's actions, especially one as conspicuous as that, is subject to the judgment of everyone else in the community. Did you ever feel that your mom and dad were harshly judged for that choice?
I never did. It was just, I think there was one other of my aunts who kept the Phelps name,
right,
when she got married. It actually kind of surprised me as I got older, and other people who got married didn't keep the Phelps name. Mm-hmm. They took their spouse's name.
Right.
But it was never something that I experienced as, you know, getting negative consequences.
Your grandfather, you know, as you said, was, you know, in Northeast Kansas and Kansas generally recognized for civil rights work before he was recognized for these pickets and for this rather extreme theology. He was a lawyer, of course, and most of his kids became lawyers as well. And it occurs to me that there's something, I wonder if you ever sense that he was drawn to adversarial or confrontational relationships generally, and the same thing that attracted him about law in which he could enter combat in the courtroom attracted him to a particularly punitive interpretation of scripture or desire to confront people with that interpretation of scripture?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think that he, I would say yes. Mm-hmm. I think just his personality, for me, as I was writing this book and kind of looking back through my memories as much as possible, and obviously my view of my grandfather is limited to, you know, stories I heard from my parents and my own experiences. So, there's not a lot of, but I think that he just, his primary characteristic seemed to be, he was so smart. He had this, he seemed to have this toxic sense of certainty mm-hmm. in his own ideas. He could not allow there to be an alternative view of something right. That he could recognize as legitimate. Mm-hmm. And that belief, that characteristic, I feel like it was the same thing that characterized my whole upbringing at Westboro, our understanding of the Bible and of our place in the world. It was all very plain and clear, black and white, and there was no question about it. His understanding was unquestionable and infallible. Uh-huh.
Did he treat legal texts and doctrines the same way that he treated Scripture, that there's one unambiguous interpretation of this law that happens to be my interpretation? My interpretation is therefore correct, and he brought that same certainty into the courtroom, and maybe that was part of what contributed to his success as a lawyer?
That would be my guess, but again, since I wasn't around for a lot of that part, unfortunately.
Right. What was the most difficult thing to revisit when writing this book? It obviously required you to stir up a lot of painful memories and difficult memories and even joyful memories that are now, in retrospect, painful because of the changes that you've undergone and the estrangement. What was the most challenging for you when you were writing the book?
I think there were two parts that were really difficult. The first one was, describing the period leading up to my departure from the church. There was a 4-month period from the moment it first occurred to me that we might be not just wrong about one or two or three or a handful of doctrines, but that our view of the world and our place in it was fundamentally mistaken, that we were not this divine institution led by Jesus Christ himself, but a group of fallible human beings. And that unraveling process, to be having this kind of boomerang effect where I'm considering all these doctrines that I had come to believe, our doctrines and actions that I had come to believe were wrong and cruel and destructive in the lives of so many people, including ourselves, and knowing, feeling so yes, this is, I know this is wrong, and then thinking, oh my God, like, what if this is Satan whispering in my ear and I can't trust myself and this is a test from God and I'm failing? And so all of this is happening in my thoughts as I am still completely enmeshed in the church and all of the activities and spending all of my time with these people who, if they knew what was happening in my mind, like, I just felt like such a betrayer. But I couldn't, I felt like I had to go through that process. I had to go through it all. If I had left, without being certain that it was the right thing to do, that would have been, I think, a really big mistake. I think it would have been even more difficult to have moved on once I actually did leave. And then the other thing that was really difficult was, the allegations of abuse in my family. That was something that I had, I had heard all, growing up. I have two uncles who left the church before I was born. Right. And, these accusations that they had made of my grandfather's, abuse of them and of his wife, my gran. And, we had always publicly denied that. And even in my own mind, as I got older, I had come to minimize what we had done, what had been done to us. And then, I left the church, and a couple days later, I was talking to my brother, mm-hmm. Who had left 8.5 years earlier.
Right.
And, I'm describing all of the trauma that I was experiencing, how much I loved and missed our mother. And, is somebody saying you can't hear? Oh, I see.
Okay.
Sorry. and he basically was, he didn't understand what I was, he didn't understand why I was feeling this way.
Right.
He said, "Do you not remember?" And he started to narrate a couple of scenes, and it all kind of came rushing back. And it had been nice to minimize those things, mm-hmm. right? Because if you minimize it, you don't, it doesn't feel like trauma.
Right.
And, you know, when I started, you know, thinking about it and remembering, and, you know, I'm not a fan of rewriting history and, right. and trying to turn yourself into a victim, and I don't feel like a victim. But you know, actually coming to terms with that, mm-hmm. because I knew that if I were ever to have children, I needed to be very clear about what had happened,
right.
and to be sure that I would not repeat those things with my own children. Right. Because I knew in that revisiting of it, I knew that you know, you repeat, you know, what you repeat what you know. And so even for my mother, I know that she was delivering a much more moderate version of that mm-hmm. to my siblings and me than what her father had done to her and her siblings.
Right.
And yet it was still abusive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's still, you know, difficult to say. But anyway, that the process of looking at things that had happened, you know, when I was a child and then trying to come to terms with it from an adult perspective, you know, I think those are the two most difficult things.
You've said, too, that one of your intentions in writing the book, it's not merely for an audience of whoever's interested in it, whoever might learn from it or benefit from it. You really did write it with your family in mind as an audience and hoping to explain yourself to them, account for yourself, and maybe patiently bring them around to seeing things ideally the way that you see them as well. Your book is dedicated to your parents, lovingly dedicated to your parents. It must have been a difficult decision to include things like, you know, an honest reckoning with physical abuse that you experienced growing up, bearing in mind that that might run counter to your purposes or not being certain how they might react to it. How did you expect that they might respond to that or rationalize it, or did you expect them to reach out to you? Any of those issues?
I mean, I knew that they would feel betrayal.
Yeah.
And that was really, you know, I hate that. I hate that anything that I do is painful to them, you know, because I don't intend to harm them. What I intend is to try to help them see things the way that people on Twitter helped me see things. Mm-hmm. You know, I was an unwilling listener. Like, I did not go to Twitter to be changed, and yet I was. Right. And so the part of the problem is that because Westboro, because they cut you off when you leave, you know, I can make these arguments to them in private, you know, and I do in letters. I reach out to them privately, but, you know, they can hide that.
Right.
They can hide that from my siblings. They can hide that from the younger members of the church who I know are, you know, on the internet. And so this is also why I feel it's important to make the arguments publicly. Mm-hmm. And also because, you know, Westboro's beliefs and actions, like, they're not the only people who have, you know, similar ideas.
Right.
There are a lot of other groups. And so it feels important to argue, you know, make these arguments in public because there are so many other people who are affected by them too. This specifically about the abuse, I felt like I could not exclude that. I tried not to gratuitously include things just for the sake of, it's salacious enough. Right. It doesn't need any help with that. So the part about the abuse, what was so important about it and why it couldn't be excluded, I think there were two things. The first was that, you know, people want to understand what does indoctrination look like.
Right.
And when you, as a kid, when you understand that you cannot push back without severe consequences,
right.
that is part of it. Before you learn fear of God and fear of hell, you understand fear of pain. And that, you know, it felt like I couldn't exclude that and write an honest account mm-hmm. of what happened. And so that was part of it. The other part was, what was the other part? Oh, yeah. It was the, you know, there's a thing that, a theme, I guess, with a bunch of things that happened at Westboro that I was, you know, recognizing as I was writing the book. This, and part of it is the willingness to lie
mm-hmm.
and to deceive
right.
In order to accomplish an objective.
Right.
Westboro has, it is anathema to them to ever admit wrongdoing,
right.
to publicly say, we messed up,
mm-hmm.
we hurt people unnecessarily, and I don't just mean the physical punishment, but we got this doctrine wrong and we've come to recognize that this was wrong. it's almost like I think part of it is just they need to maintain this sense that they are the authority, and to never cast doubt upon that. The funny thing is, of course, is that nobody sees them as an authority except themselves. So they're protecting their own, you know, their own view of themselves.
Self-conception,
yeah. Yes, exactly. Their own self-conception. And so, you know, you have to say that. I can't say that without saying it. And to say it publicly, unfortunately, is one of the few ways to kind of force them to consider what they're doing. And to make a public reckoning, and to encourage them to do so too.
Pivoting to maybe a little bit of a lighter subject.
That would be nice.
Yeah. I the first section of the book that I read, which, you know, survived largely, I think, intact into the memoir, was involved your courtship online with Chad, who's now your husband, and you played very spirited games of words with friends with him, and then you would communicate using the chat function of Words with Friends, which allowed you something longer than the Twitter character limit, and you really started to tease out ideas and you know, explain your positions on different issues, but also you shared recommendations of bands and books, and you did all the things that flirting couples do, you know, but, well, not all of the things, you know, you, but one of the things that's so wonderful about that section is that it's like reading a Jane Austen novel. Everything is happening through written correspondence, but most of it's happening between the lines, too, because so much is off limits, so much isn't permissible to discuss, and so you infer a great deal from a simple, subtle, potentially meaningless gesture. Oh my gosh, he played the word unrequited in Words with Friends. What does this mean? You know, and you go around buzzing, thinking about that all day.
All day,
that's right, yeah, yeah. So that chapter really captured that feeling that I think everyone can identify with, of just being infatuated and letting that kind of take over your life. Complicated, of course, in your case, by the fact that there was all of this attendant guilt and desire for secrecy and things like that. Nevertheless, that was a really fun chapter to read, and I suspect it was a fun chapter to write. What was the most fun you had when writing the memoir?
That chapter.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
It makes sense that that's the first thing that I would write. Right. I mean, which at that time, I was actually only writing it as a gift for my husband for Christmas. Right. And it was, you know, because of course if I would have jumped right into the horrible parts, like I doubt it would have actually finished writing.
Right.
That chapter was so fun because it let me, you know, I was writing about the man I loved, you know, and all of the ways that his approach to those conversations helped broaden my horizons. Like, and who doesn't like to think about all the things about the person they love and all the ways that they're wonderful. There was so much about that it was really fun to go back and remember all of the, you know, aspects of him. So for instance, the fact that he would express a really strong opinion and then, you know, not that long later, completely reverse himself on it. And, you know, at first I was like, I can't trust anything this guy says. And then I realized, you know, this is actually a really admirable trait, the fact that he can be changed by new evidence.
Right.
And, you know, that's obviously something at Westboro, like, we had the truth of God. It was unquestionable. We couldn't change our minds about anything. or so it seemed. And so, you know, just little things like that. It was amazing to really tease out, like, what exactly did he do differently than other people that had such an effect on the way I saw the world. And he wasn't the only one. There was this group of people on Twitter who, you know, were willing to have these conversations with me. So, and it wasn't that, you know, Twitter was just, you know, this just wonderful, you know, unicorn place where everybody was great. It was just a few people among a deluge of, you know, confrontation and aggression and, you know, who were willing to ask questions and to have real deep conversations and to, you know, get into the nuances of what we believed and why. And, you know, that was huge in helping change my heart and mind.
One of those was David Abbott Ball, who blogs as Julicious, is that right? And,
yes.
And when, it was interesting to me that when you left the church, his attitude wasn't victory, you know, or my work is done, you know, or anything like that. Mm-hmm. His attitude was, now we need to really challenge you. Like, he wanted you to come and speak at the Julius Festival. He wanted you to visit the Museum of Tolerance. He wanted to talk with you about translation, scriptural interpretation, you know, and things like that, and really dig into it. And that seems to, you know, that bespeaks a real, an impressive perspective, I think, to recognize that you're, this is just one step you've made in your journey. It's a significant step, leaving Westboro Baptist, but you're still sorting things out, and perhaps he can go on helping just as he's helped you come this far.
Yeah, it was one of the things that really surprised me, because I, you know, when I first started talking to him, what he said was, I mean, when I first started talking to him after I left the church, you know, he taught me, he talked about two things. First, he felt responsible for, you're right, he didn't think it was just victory, right? He understood the incredible cost of leaving. He saw my sister and me completely lost in the world, having no idea which way was up. We, you know, knew that there were a lot of things about Westboro that we didn't believe, but, you know, you don't just, it's not just like a flip switches.
Right.
Switch flips.
A flipped switch. Yeah.
Yes. It's like, it's a process, and he recognized that, and his willingness to go through that with us
right.
Was just incredibly valuable. I would never have done, you know, as, you know, to become, to publicly address these things. You know, when I first left, I thought I just had to run away and hide from it forever, that there was no chance that I was ever going to be able to move on from the person that I'd been. And so for him to say, you can, here, come here, talk to us. Like, you can learn about Judaism. We'll tell you all that, like, you have all these ideas about Jewish people. Like, this is a chance for you to actually, you know, meet some of us. And, and you know, one of the things that he taught me from Judaism that has really been, you know, something that has shaped my path since I left was this concept called tikkun olam, mm-hmm. which means to repair the world. And as he explained it, it is the idea that it is incumbent upon every human being to see the brokenness in the world and to do what we can to repair it. Mm-hmm. And that it is the work of a lifetime and that it is never done. And, you know, for him to, you know, what he said was, you know, you and your family have added to that brokenness. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as much as you can, you have a duty to try to repair some of it. Mm-hmm. And the idea that we could do something, that I could do something to repair it, that it wasn't a hopeless, you know, a hopeless thing to even attempt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I recognize that there was a lot of things, and this is something that is still hard for me to think about, but, you know, I will never be able to give back, you know, the days that people were going to bury their loved ones. And that is devastating. And I think in the absence of David's kind of gentle prodding, and, you know, giving me and my sister this inspiration from Judaism and other places to try to work to make change, that I would have just, you know, despaired mm-hmm. and just been paralyzed and kind of given up and stepped away and just let that be that.
Mm. You were in David's presence when you learned that Gramps was in hospice, is that correct?
Yeah.
And there's a really compelling scene where you describe David asking you what's wrong. You've just gotten the news over the phone, I think, and he asks you what's wrong. And you have to, before you can tell him, ask him, if I told you that something bad had happened to my grandfather, you wouldn't be joyful about that, would you? And you had to establish that. And he, you know, to his great credit, says, of course not. But beyond that, he went on and prayed for Gramps, and he went to the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem and submitted a prayer for him. It just strikes me as one of the most extraordinary things that perhaps has ever happened on earth, you know, and I wonder if David, you know, learned from and benefited from your company too. That may always have been there, you know, in his character, but I bet he didn't foresee that he would one day be at the Wailing Wall praying for the health of the Reverend Fred Phelps. Did he talk to you at all about that and about your friendship affecting him?
Yeah, so actually at that very first, you know, I went back to the Julius Festival, which I had protested 3 years earlier.
Right.
And, you know, as we're having this conversation, it came to a point where, you know, he's basically leading the conversation in this room that is entirely silent. It was full of people and it felt like no one was moving. And it came to a point where, you know, my sister and I were both weeping. You know, it had come to the part where we had left and what that meant and what it had cost us. And, you know, he kind of jumped in for a few minutes and was just talking, and he said that one of his revelations in that week that we had spent with him leading up to the festival was that you know, he wants to believe that, well, first, if he had grown up the way that we did, that he would have been out there protesting right alongside Grandpa Phelps, as he put it, and that he wants to believe that if it came to it, that he would have made the same decision that we would, that he would have left,
right.
You know, when he came to the realization that we were wrong. But what he said was, I want to say that. I don't know that I could. I don't know that I could give up my entire family. I mean, the empathy that he showed us and that he demonstrated mm-hmm. for this, you know, group of people. We had been, at that protest 3 years earlier, it had been incredibly acrimonious. We had been surrounded. You know, the Long Beach police were, you know, watching the counter-protesters surround us, hit us with their signs, were laughing and encouraging it. And so it had not been a good thing. So to now be sitting in front of these people saying we were wrong, it was a terrifying mm-hmm. thing. And so for him to be modeling that kind of empathy and compassion and grace in that moment was just, it was the exact opposite of what I expected when I left.
He said memorably and ironically that leaving Westboro Baptist Church is the most Westboro Baptist Church thing that you and Grace could have done. That's a lot to wrap one's mind around. What all did that statement entail? Like, what all did he mean by that when he said this is an incredibly WBC thing that you did leaving WBC?
Well, he said that our leaving was both a rejection and an affirmation of everything that we'd been taught. Mm-hmm. He said that, you know, our family, they were the ones who taught us to stand up for what we believe in, right. no matter what it cost us. They just never imagined that we'd be standing up to them.
Right.
And so it was that, you know, his acknowledgement that there was a lot of good. Mm-hmm. Like, again, it's one of those things that it was the opposite of what I expected. Right. The day that I left, my cousin, you know, came into my room as I was packing and crying and just a total wreck. And she was saying that, you know, nobody's going to let you live this down unless you just lie about us, say all kinds of terrible things about us. You're not going to be able to tell the truth with any kind of, you know, and I believed her. And so again, to have immediately, you know, connected with David and for him to be willing to allow for the humanity and the goodness of my family, to acknowledge that within this incredibly destructive environment, there was also an amazing amount of goodness. You know, he also said, you know, he talked about, so we were, my sister and I were staying in the home of the rabbi that we had protested 3 years earlier with my sister having held a sign calling that rabbi a whore. So now we're in his home, staying in his home in the living room with his little five-year-old coming to wake us up in the morning with his little Mickey Mouse hat. And it's just this very, you know, wonderful family environment. And, you know, we're asking them all kinds of questions about, you know, like Shabbat and, you know, celebrating with them. And he said, he was telling this group of people, like, you guys are like the best house guests we've ever had. helping clean up. You know, my sister actually stayed and, you know, helped paint the kitchen for Passover and all this. And you know, and he was saying, like, clearly you are the product of very attentive, loving parents who taught you, you know, good ways of being in the world. They just also taught you all these other things that they themselves were taught as children.
Right.
And so again, that his willingness to see the complexity of the situation, to not just write off our family as completely evil and irredeemable, it was just really amazing and wonderful, especially in the direct aftermath of leaving them.
Writing is a way of sort of being in your own company and learning from yourself. And we've talked a little bit in the past about how you needed to write parts of the book in order to know what it was that you actually thought about that or had to say about that. What was the biggest revelation that came to you through the act of writing, the biggest discovery that you made? You'd obviously learned a great deal leading up to your leaving, but after your leaving, when you're writing the book, what was the most interesting moment of clarity or new insight or new discovery?
This might seem like maybe not a huge thing, but for me, you know, growing up at Westboro, they believe in, you know, predestination. So everything just happens as it happens because God made it happen.
Right.
And, you know, afterward, and as my, you know, views on that and theology started to evolve, you know, I came to a place where, you know, examining the human, like, causal factors mm-hmm. for why things happened the way that they did, I had never connected, and again, this might seem stupid, I had never connected that it was in the, you know, immediate aftermath, like just a couple of months after my grandfather lost his license to practice at the federal level. So right when there's this enormous vacuum in his life of this meaning and purpose, this mission, the civil rights work that he had been doing for decades at that point, right at that moment, that is when the incident occurs at Gage Park that sparked our protesting.
Right.
And because I think there was actually a 2-year delay from the moment that, you know, that incident happened to when the protesting started. So I think that's why I never connected it.
Right.
But it had happened just in the immediate aftermath. And so it was like right at that point, it's like the end of one crusade leads directly into the beginning of another.
Mm-hmm.
And just pondering, like, I wonder what would have happened in the absence of,
right.
of that, you know, that his loss of that license. Would my family even be, like, they would just be known for this wonderful civil rights work that they'd done.
Mm.
And yeah, they were still hated for, you know, some of their more, I just don't think the aggressive religious side of things would have ever gotten to the point that it is now.
That's
in the absence of that.
It suggests the need for a crusade, almost irrespective of what the crusade is, that it's something that inheres
yeah.
in the crusader.
Mm-hmm.
That's
and Westboro would, again, they would just see that as, oh, well, God made that happen because
right.
it was so important for us to do this work. Whereas, you know, now I look at it and think, oh, my God, what would our lives have been? It's almost, the counterfactual is so, it's the difference is just so huge that it's hard to even consider.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Roads not taken. There's an amazing scene where you're walking on the campus of the University of Virginia with your Aunt Margie, in where she's gone to prepare for making oral arguments before the Supreme Court in the Snyder versus Phelps case, where she's going to be representing the church. And suddenly she's in tears, as I recall from reading the scene. And she's looking around at the houses and the campus and the college town environment there in Charlottesville and is saying, you know, this is where I would be. One of these houses would be mine, or I would be probably a professor, maybe teaching law somewhere at a university like this. This is the life that I gave up because I was saved. And as I'm reading it, I'm expecting to be to encounter the sentence, thank God, praise God for reaching out to me and saving me. But it's a much more melancholy scene. It's she felt... you know, entitled to be open with you about a real sense of regret and loss there. Do you think about that with other members of your family and see particular potentials that could have been realized that haven't been or that maybe one day will be? And was that part of the motivation for writing the book too? That's like 17 questions,
ooh.
I realize.
I mean, I don't know. It's, again, Westboro sees it as so... unquestionable.
Right.
Everything that they've done, everything that, you know, all, every step that they've taken is ordered of the Lord, they would
right.
say.
Right.
And so even Margie in that moment, like, it absolutely felt like, you know, melancholy. I think regret might be too strong of a word.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that the idea of, you know, this other life that she could have lived. People would say those kinds of things to us. Like, what would this family be doing if they weren't doing this crazy stuff, you know,
right.
that's how they would see it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, we just thought, no, this is so important. This
mm-hmm.
is the word of God.
What could be more important?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I think for most of the people there, I don't think it's something that they really consider. It's not something that I ever considered.
Uh-huh.
Not really. I mean, occasionally I would see like a classmate of mine, like mm-hmm. some path that they had taken that landed them, I don't know, working at Google or something.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, part of me feeling a little bit relieved at not having to have, you know, to have had this path laid out entirely for me, that I didn't have to make those decisions. I couldn't misstep because there literally was no space to misstep.
Right.
But, you know, there's also part of me that felt a little bit, you know, cowardly, you know, for that. But, you know, mostly you just accept.
Mm-hmm.
I accepted the constraints on my life because this was just what God required me to do.
If you could go back and tell Megan of 2009 that we'd be having this conversation a decade later about a book that you'd written, that you're married and with literally the most adorable baby daughter that anyone has ever seen. I know all babies are cute. I mean, no offense to anybody else with a baby in their life here, but you've got to see this baby. I mean, it's just, how might she react? That may be, I don't know, that may be too much pressure to put on 2009 Megan, I don't know.
It would be my worst nightmare, I think.
Yeah.
I would have seen it as a complete failure, that it would be proof that I lacked grace, the grace of God. You know, it's one of those things, like, sometimes people will ask me, you know, what would I say to myself, you know, back then, or what would I say to my family now? And it's still so hard to frame the words. It's easier now than it used to be. I literally used to not be able to do it at all when I first left, because I knew how my family would hear those words, which was be to not hear them at all.
Right.
And then I realized, you know, I have to get over that, because if I, you know, I understand where they're coming from better than almost anyone else on this earth. And if, you know, for David to have taken the time, David and Chad and others took the time to try to understand, it would be just the waste of a gift, you know, that I have, knowing where they're coming from, to try to change their minds, to try to help them at least moderate, even if they never get to the place where I am now, you know. Not that I'm like the pinnacle of anything or whatever, but I mean, just, I'm not trying to, you know, say that they have to believe everything that I believe now, but that for them to be able to moderate and to, in other words, to be creating fewer victims, you know, with the things that they're doing, it's important to try. And so mostly I can't speak in generalities. Because I know that the things that were the most powerful to me when I was there were very specific arguments about internal inconsistencies between, you know, within our ideology, and then, you know, inconsistencies of our doctrine and our behavior and passages from the Bible. So that is largely, when I reach out to them now, that it is on that wise, it is in that way, to try to help them, because I know that, again, for where they are now, that is going to be the most compelling, because to try to, you know, for instance, there's this moment that I write about in the book of shortly after I left, deciding to go with my sister to run away and read books in South Dakota.
Right.
And, you know, I go to the Lawrence Public Library to gather some books to bring along, and I'm staring up at the philosophy section, all these, you know, centuries worth of human attempts to understand life, and just all of a sudden it hitting me, how did I ever believe that we were the only people who had found the one true way? Like, the inherent arrogance of that, the total lack of understanding of how limited our perspectives necessarily are as human beings, how had that never caused me to think, maybe I should think about other people's ideas too. And it just never did. And so I don't think those kinds of arguments for where Westboro members, most of them are now, are going to be compelling to them. So I try to focus on the things that I think, it's not that I never make those arguments, because again, who knows what little seed of doubt will be planted and maybe eventually bloom.
Yeah.
So I occasionally do make those arguments, but for the most part, it is very specific theological arguments about specific things that they're doing.
Right. Trying to, over time, catalyze that larger change.
Exactly.
I've been trying to glance at your upside-down watch to monitor the time, and I just realized there's a giant clock over here that I could have been looking at all this time. I believe that there's some time for questions from
the
audience.
Can I just say one thing?
Oh,
I was
going to
read this
do.
At the very beginning,
yeah.
Just because Eric gave such a wonderful introduction, and I just want to read this one part of my acknowledgments, which is the largest part of my acknowledgments is for Eric McHenry. My friend and mentor, Eric McHenry, played an instrumental role in bringing this book to life. Eric, when I first asked you to edit that essay back in 2014, my only goal was to write something beautiful for the man I loved. But with your endless encouragement, it became something more. I have no idea where I'd be if you hadn't been so willing to share your writerly wisdom, to read so many of my ugly first drafts, to connect me with a wonderful editor who became my wonderful editor, and to write on my behalf to literary agents. Given how reluctant I was to write about my life, I have every reason to believe that this book wouldn't exist without you. I am forever in your debt. It just feels important to say that, so that if anybody, I mean, this is why we're here tonight, and it's all, you know, thanks to
That is incredibly generous. Thank you very much for saying that. It's characteristically modest of you to call them ugly first drafts. They weren't ugly first drafts. I'm a writing professor. I know writing. And I looked at them and I said, these are really great. This should be a book. It's ready to be a book right now. I feel like I'm getting credit for pointing in at an elephant and saying, that's big. That's big. Like, look, everybody. It just it came to me first. But thank you. That's so generous of you. Here we have a microphone. So I will turn it over to people with questions.
Technically cheating because I'm a tech and I stood here by the mic purposefully. I grew up in a far-right evangelical fundamentalist church that people consider a cult, which it probably is. And I very distinctly remember the first week where I realized that I was able to pretend I wasn't, that I ended up going to art school and having coffee and being out with people, and I had this one moment where I realized, oh my God, I can pretend I'm anybody else. What was that moment for you? What was that like time for you? Or have you had that?
You mean being anybody else?
Yeah.
Well, this is a good question. When I first left, I thought, you know, running away was my only option. And I mentioned where I ran away to was Deadwood, South Dakota. Right, to read books. The very first night that I was in town, I unpacked my car with my sister. Then we walked down Main Street. So Deadwood, you know, very tiny tourist town in, you know, the middle of nowhere, basically. Yeah. It's completely empty and snowing and freezing, you know, freezing cold. We walked to the end of the road and into the first, you know, we walked into the Four Aces Casino. And that, the very first place we wandered into, I was recognized. So I realized that one of the dealers was a fan of the director, Kevin Smith, who I had sparred with on Twitter. So it's this whole, you know, I realized almost immediately that I couldn't pretend. I was, you know, all over the internet. I had been a very zealous, loud voice for the church. It had become, you know, so that was the first, you know, indication, like, oh, maybe this isn't going to be so easy. And then, you know, shortly after that on Twitter, because I had been, you know, such a, you know, active Twitter user, the fact that I had almost and entirely stopped tweeting, there was a bunch of people, like, the hashtag was, where is Megan Phelps Roper? Like, so, I mean, clearly this was not something that I could just walk away from and pretend, you know. And then pretty quickly, even though at first it felt like I was being forced to confront this thing that I just didn't feel prepared to confront at all, even in my own mind, you know, I really, really quickly realized it was actually a gift, you know, that I didn't want to. I needed to make amends. I needed to try to find a way of making things right as much as I could. And so, you know, it's really funny. Recently, there's this article in the Sydney Morning Herald, and I really liked the way that it began and that it ended. It began with, you know, I was recently, for the first time since I left, introduced as Megan Phelps Roper, author, instead of Megan Phelps Roper, former member of Westboro Baptist Church, which, when you're in, like, a conference where, like, everybody else is, like, the director of a nonprofit, you know, I don't know, just doing all kinds of wonderful things in the world, and then me, former member of Westboro Baptist Church, gets a little awkward. And so it was really nice, you know, to, like, be, I have very slowly, over the last almost 7 years, come to the point where I can start to pivot and do something else. And I'm looking forward to that. And that's how the article ended, you know, how I'm grateful for the opportunity to have it not be so intensely about just my experiences. Because, you know, you started this saying you grew up in a very similar environment. That was another thing that I was shocked to learn when I left, is how common and human the forces are that have made Westboro what they are, and how widespread, even though the ideology, you know, manifests a little uniquely at Westboro, you know, the protesting of funerals, things like that, the doctrines themselves and the way they manifest within the churches, like, it's, there are so many groups like that, and it's shocking. But anyway, this is a long answer to that question.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm curious. I'm going to set up this scenario. You're in a time. You and your husband are in a time warp, and you're thrown back to the 1950s, Topeka. Mm-hmm. Have you ever thought about the fact that if that happened, you and him, your husband, might be toe to toe with Phelps, because back then he was on the same side that you would have been back then, that you all would have been on the same side by equal choice, not because your family forced you into it or anything, but you all would have been on the same side in that scenario. Has you ever considered that, or would you talk about that a little bit?
I guess I don't quite understand what you're...
Well, that on back in the 50s, he was on the right side. He's on the same side as you are now.
Oh, Gramps.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm sorry, I didn't...
Yes.
Gramps, right. Gramps, you would have been toe-to-toe with Gramps back then, because he was fighting for civil rights. It's incredibly ironic, and I'd just like you to maybe talk about that, the irony of that a little bit.
Well, I mean, I think that his civil rights work, I think that was a good thing. I wouldn't have been standing against him on that at all.
I think he means aligned with, rather
you
than
you would have been with him.
He doesn't mean opposed to, he means you would have been
on the same side.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, shoulder to shoulder.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is one of those things, again, I think that speaks to the complexity of human beings, that we all have the potential for both great good and great evil, and to do wonderful things to help others, and then also the harm that we did. I always go back to the funeral protests as I think were the worst, but the rest of it, I still hear from people who were questioning their sexuality at a young age and tempted to commit suicide and things like that. So we harmed a lot of people. My grandfather also helped a lot of people. I don't think the one erases the other. And so we just need to try as much as we can to encourage the goodness in others, especially when we see them doing destructive things.
Hi, I have a question. You had talked in the beginning about Twitter being a positive vehicle for reaching out and reaching people.
Yeah.
Dan Savage talks about this in his project, the It Gets Better campaign. He talks about going into to kids' devices and reaching them and saying you're not alone.
Yeah.
And I have a sense that's kind of what you're doing with the general public. In regards to your family, the one narrative throughout the whole book that you can really listen to is your heartbreak and your heartache as it applies to your family and wanting to get them back. I know what that's like. I won't bore you with the details. But do you have a sense of, with Twitter and still communicating with them in some sense, do you feel like you are reaching some people in your church, in your family? Obviously, you probably can't comment on any direct messages you may have had with people in there, but is it... It's not all for naught, is it? Do you feel like you are casting seeds of doubt and/or seeds of hope for that particular 80 some people in the church?
Yeah, I don't think it's for naught. And initially I thought, first I thought I just despaired, right? That I could never actually have any effect. And then pretty quickly I thought, how dare I not have hope for them? I was reached by the gentle persuasion of outsiders, and so, why couldn't they be? And so this is when, my sister and I started reaching out, sending messages, in the mail. We started sending tweets. I write in the book about a couple of these things, but the first thing that I saw was, the day that I left, I specifically mentioned two picket signs that I thought were unscriptural, and one of them said that, that gays couldn't repent. And so for 2.5 years, I was making arguments about this, both on Twitter and in interviews that I was giving. And for a while, for that whole 2.5 years, they just doubled down. Those two signs, which had been relatively little used, were suddenly everywhere. And so 2.5 years later, I wake up one morning, February 2015, and see this a tweet that says, about that gays can't repent sign. They, for the first time ever, publicly disavowed a picket sign, and using the same verses that I had been referencing. It was one of those things that it made me realize, I knew that they could be reached, but to even have this little bit of proof that change was possible, I was like, yes! and there's many more. I mean, since then, I think the biggest one is this, you know, praying for bad things to happen to people, for praying for God's curses on your enemies. We would quote these passages where David, you know, prays for his enemies' children to be fatherless and for their wives to be widows. So he's explicitly calling for the death of these his enemies. And so again, it was a similar situation where for a while, it was a period, I think this was a period of months, they just doubled down, you know, like just repeating the verses that supported their position and not addressing the contradictory ones, like Jesus saying, love your enemies, you know, pray, bless them that curse you, pray for them that despitefully use you and persecute you, and Paul saying, you know, bless them that persecute you, bless and curse not. And so, again, the doubling down, and then there came a point where my dad gave a sermon about that, love your enemies. And like very shortly after that, you know, Westboro had I'll get to the point soon. There's a news release that went out every Friday, and it, you know, 15 soldiers had died that week. It would list the 15 soldiers and say, thank God for 15 dead soldiers. We pray for 15,000 more. And that second part of that, they took that off. They changed it. And, you know, they stopped holding the pray for more dead soldiers sign and pray for more dead kids. And I always have to note that it is a very low bar for human decency to not pray for people to die, but for Westboro,
enlightenment.
Yeah. But for Westboro, like they believed that this was a divine doctrine. So the fact that they could change it, that was really positive. Very recently, in the last few days, I was tweeting with an uncle of mine, and again, it was one of those things where, for the first time ever, I've been talking about our conduct at those funerals, that it was unscriptural. You know, again, another thing from Paul, he says, to the weak I became as weak, that I might gain the weak. And even if they could make an argument for why they had to be outside of those funerals, they did not have to be out there singing happy birthday September 11. They didn't have to be out there playing flag soccer. They didn't have to be out there, we didn't have to be out there singing and dancing, you know, singing praises to the IEDs, the homemade bombs that were killing America. We didn't have to do those things. And I actually got a response from my uncle saying, in a very distant, you know, distancing himself and the church from any direct acknowledgement that they had misbehaved, you know, to admit that those things were wrong. Spiteful joy is never wrong. That humble servants of God are always... they're repentant, you know, when they make mistakes in you know, preaching God's word. So all this like very theoretical language, but that's important. It's important for them to acknowledge it. I hope eventually it will cause them to have a different feeling. You know, they claim in certain ways to have changed, how their approach to outsiders, to have gotten rid of that spiteful joy, and yet. Just a few weeks ago, one of my aunts, you know, retweeted some terrible thing that had happened and said, ha, in response, you know. So it's really hard to change those deeply ingrained feelings, but I absolutely believe that they can be changed, and I'm going to keep doing everything I can.
Thank you, everyone, once again. One more round of applause for Megan Phelps-Roper.
Thank you, and Eric. Thank you so much.